Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan. Welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. And today we're going to be talking about our bodies, our health and our rights. And I have Fifa Rahman, Nisha Ayub and Martin Chu, all of them who are going to be contributing to this discussion focused on HIV AIDS, but you know, really with implications for larger society. But before we get to that, we're going to look at some of the latest news that we have had today, things that are getting people talking. And we're going to we have on the line with us Jahaba Sadiq from the Malaysian Insight. Thank you, Jahaba, for joining us. I want to begin with Nurul Izzah's resignation. She, of course, is Pematang Power MP, also daughter of Anwar Ibrahim and the Deputy Prime Minister, Wan Azizah Wan Ismail. Were you surprised by her move?
Of course. I mean, I don't think anybody expected it at all. Things look fine. She was chairing TVET meetings. She had just won the vice presidency, and yesterday she was appointed as Penang PKR chairman. So it was totally unexpected that she would quit both her party post and also anything to do with the government.
There was, of course, the very bruising party elections, and she was seen as allied to Rafizi Ramli in the Rafizi Ramli Azmin Ali contest over the deputy presidency. Do you think that had anything to do with this, as it were, second leg of the rivalry within PKR?
Actually, I don't think it has anything to do with Rafizi Azmin contest. I think the content of her resignation letter and notice is that she's been thinking about it for some time. And I think there probably be other kind of differences within the party, with the top leadership, and you know, probably also being seen as just another worker rather than a leader and owner. I mean, we've seen her grow up in the last 20 years, you know, from the time her father was sacked and was sent to jail to now her father and she herself being part of the coalition that won the government. But I think there are other reasons than that losing contest at all.
Well, because, you know, there are people who have come out across both sides of the aisle. We had Khairi Jamaluddin tweeting about it. We had Rais Hussein from Bersatu also tweeting about it. She took exception to Rais and his comments. She seemed to welcome comments from Khairi about her contribution to the development of Malaysian politics. Do you think if she steps away and she's not persuaded to return, that this is going to be a loss for the reform agenda?
I think it's definitely going to be a big loss for the reform agenda or for Malaysia in the larger picture. For one, she should have been in the cabinet. I mean, she's been at the forefront for the last 20 years, right? The reform government now. Why isn't she in the cabinet or in any a position of a lot more responsibility than just being chairing the TVET committee, for instance? And even in the party, I think she probably wants a bigger role, or she should get a bigger role. She's not recognized for her contributions. And I think after 20 years, maybe she, one, is fed up with the whole thing, two, wants to focus on her family. She is a single mother after all.
Well, TVET, of course, is a reference to vocational training and the development of that. The question now, of course, when you say that she deserved a role in cabinet, there's always these trade-offs around the question of nepotism. Her mother is in cabinet. Her father will come to cabinet at some point. Do you think that weighs heavily on the Pakatan Harapan, the optics of having even the most credible leaders in cabinet if they're related to each other?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, she's proven herself in the last 20 years that she can stand on her own 2 feet. If we keep referring to her as daughter of Anwar Ibrahim, we do her no justice. Or she's the daughter of one of them, we do her no justice. I think she's done more in the last 20 years than her father or her mother.
Okay, let's move away from the question of Nurul Izzah's resignation. I believe tomorrow the Political Bureau will meet and perhaps, we'll see a change that was anticipated by Rais Hussein from Bersatu. He says that he thinks they'll be able to persuade her to not resign or as we'll pull back her letter of resignation. Now, I want to talk about Tun Dr. Mahathir and his statement today that Parti Pribumi Bersatu Malaysia, or Bersatu, will not open a chapter in Sabah. Were you surprised by this announcement?
No, I think he's just being politically wise about it. You know, he's got a partner in Sabah. And I mean, realistically, the chaps who quit Sabah UMNO are quite lightweight, really. Won't further the pre-booming cause in the peninsula, where they have focused a lot more in the last elections. They're primarily, as they call themselves, a Malay party. The chaps in Sabah are not Malay, as it were. I mean, might be a rumpun Melayu as we talk about it, but no, I think it doesn't benefit pre-Bumi at all to have these UMNO chaps from Sabah to join them.
But isn't pre-Bumi, of all the parties, Bersatu, as I call it, don't they need the numbers? Because they're the third largest in a coalition of four parties, and they could use a boost with their numbers, at least in terms of a scenario post Dr. Mahathir. Wouldn't that be useful for them? And to give up this excellent opportunity, I mean, just to give a recap for our viewers, UMNO Sabah has near collapse. 9 of their 10 state assemblymen have quit. 5 of their 6 MPs have quit, and 22 of their 25 division chiefs have quit. Isn't this an excellent opportunity for them to build the party or build some part of the party for them?
Of course it is. But yeah, you have to look beyond just the current parliament. If they accept all these guys, do you think these guys can withstand the next election? I don't think so. I think they've got in by the fact that they were in UMNO. They've jumped at the earliest possible time they could jump, 6-7 months later. I think their loyalty is suspect.
Well, OK, Parti Warisan Sabah Deputy President Daryl Lee King says that there is, in fact, an unwritten agreement between Warisan and Bersatu. And as you know, there was in Sarawak an unwritten agreement between UMNO and the party there in Sarawak. But, well, let's put that aside and move on to the next question of who Bersatu is, in fact, accepting. And there was a question of Rahim Tambi Chik's membership. Apparently, he's applied. He applied with 100 others in Melaka in a ceremony that had the Entrepreneur and Development Minister presiding. Were you surprised by that, Jahaba? I'm hoping that you're surprised by something today.
I'm surprised by a lot of things, but not politics. No, I think yeah, there is some surprise that they would consider accepting Rahim Tambi Chik. But I think if we look at the history of Rahim Tambi Chik and Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, he used to be a political protege of Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. He was one of the longest-serving chief ministers in Melaka. And I presume the Bersatu chapter in Melaka thinks that his influence is there for them to accept and get more state assemblymen and show up their position in Melaka itself rather than federal politics. But, you know, I mean, he's basically a stand for us. I mean, he's a man from the past. And what can he possibly offer Bersatu in the federal sense?
Right, so this is an interesting question because if he certainly might need a Bersatu or want to be on the Pakatan bandwagon, but what is it that they could get from him? Is he a warlord? Does he remain a kind of UMNO warlord that can bring resources or individuals or machinery with him?
Well, okay, from the reports that we have, UMNO has 13 state assemblymen in Melaka. He can possibly influence 3 to join Bersatu. So that means Bersatu will have 5 in Melaka and further erode the UMNO position in Melaka. Yeah, but, you know, Melaka is a very small state. What are they fighting for? The chief minister is from Amana. The biggest party in Pakatan there is DAP. There's not much they can get from that state, really. I mean, if you think about it. I'm just looking at it from a federal point of view. From a state point of view, it doesn't make Bersatu any more powerful than they are right now.
Okay, and last question for you, Jahaba. Does Pakatan need a two-thirds majority, and will the defectors coming from UMNO help them if this is the end game for all these defections, the achievement of a two-thirds majority?
I think we've just been debated about this two-thirds majority for a long time, to amend laws easily, amend the constitution. I think Ambiga Srinivasan is right to say that there should be bipartisanship in the parliament on laws that benefit the Malaysian people at large. I think our politicians need to grow up. They don't need to be in the same group just to get laws to go through. They need to think of the country and not of themselves first.
Thank you so much. That was Jahaba Sadiq from the Malaysian Insight. We'll be back with FIFA Rama, Nisha Ayub, Martin Chu. Stay tuned.
HIV has a direct impact on businesses. It is therefore crucial for Malaysia to invest in a policy that will provide support for those infected and affected by HIV at the workplace. HIV discrimination is unlawful and should not be tolerated in these days and age.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, FIFA Rahman, Nisha Ayub and Martin Chu. We're going to be talking about precisely the issues there that were brought up by Dr. Zulkifli Ahmad, Minister of Health, at the Malaysian AIDS Foundation Gala Dinner last night. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to introduce you all, because some people might not know who you are. Nisha Ayub, you're a project manager with SEED Foundation, also a founder of Justice for Sisters.
That's right.
And I'm going to go through your extraordinary CV that includes having a slug, a sea slug, named for you. FIFA Rahman is a member of the board of UNITAID, which is an organisation that funds research in and also initiatives in HIV/AIDS globally. And you can tell us more about that, FIFA. FIFA is also a doctoral candidate at the University of Leeds. Martin Chu from the KL/AIDS Support Services Society. And we had you on just last week in a phoner, didn't we, Martin?
That's right.
Wonderful. Okay, so you're all here and we're going to talk about our bodies and we're going to talk about our health and we're going to talk about our rights as they relate to HIV/AIDS or more. Do want to say that I'm extraordinarily jealous of you, Nisha, for having a city in the US declare a day for you. There's a Nisha Ayub Day in a US city. 5th of April is the day. Isn't that extraordinary?
Fantastic.
How did that happen? Okay, now on to some really serious matters. I think, I wanted all of you to be here tonight because there are very difficult conversations we need to have when we talk about HIV/AIDS, either lessening transmissions or dealing with a patient that's developed the AIDS disease and so on and so forth. And last week I had Professor Adiba, who is the chairperson of the Malaysian AIDS Foundation. We talked about this. It seems that we've reached a level where we can cure. We have all the tools, Martin. That's what you
That's
said.
Right.
That's an expression you use. We have all the tools, but we're not necessarily getting on top of the problem. The question is, what is not happening in our country? And I want to ask FIFA if you could help us understand what you think. And you were on board with MAC as a policy manager, and now you're looking at precisely some of these issues. What is not happening in our country? What are the conversations we're not having?
Yeah, the conversations are largely policy related and enabling factors. The enabling environment isn't there. We still have a culture of conservatism that ignores data. Of course, we have experts that are following the data, but when the entire policy environment is not conducive to supporting these, you don't achieve the results you want. For example, to give one example, is decriminalisation of drug use. Now, everybody thinks that if you decriminalise drug use, people will just use drugs everywhere. But say, if you give me a syringe, I'm not going to use drugs. There's no way I'm going to start using drugs. And you know what the data shows in Portugal, Switzerland, all the countries that have either decriminalisation or de facto decriminalisation, is that what happens is they divert people into health and welfare services, and including they make them sign in at employment centres. Mm-hmm. So this increases employment, the data shows that this reduces overdose deaths, this improves stability. So, you know, if we look past emotion, you know, negative emotion, and look more at data and what that will result in, you'll see that policy changes are what need to be done.
Okay, so let's leave that there. I mean, we're going to come back to that because we have a new government and we're hoping that these new conversations potentially can start things changing. And perhaps what is civil service, at least in that segment of the government, that's moribund, that's not thinking about new ideas and such. Yeah. Martin, what's your experience been? I mean, you are there straddling the research into HIV/AIDS. You worked on fishermen and transmission using using a drug or intravenous transmissions.
That's right.
But you're also providing support services.
Right.
Tell us about the difficult conversations for someone who works in your field.
We have a sexual epidemic at the moment.
A sexual epidemic,
yes. So HIV is a sexual epidemic since 2010. 2010, there was a parity where the epidemic is mainly transmitted, a parity between injection drug use and sexual transmission. Since then, year on year, is becoming more and more a sexual epidemic. Today, it's largely a sexual epidemic. In order for us to really deal with a sexual epidemic, we really need to talk about sex, because you can't talk about risk behavior and you can't talk about prevention and protection without really getting into the nitty-gritty and talking about sex. So that's where the conversation gets stuck.
Okay, some of us love to talk about sex, and I think a lot of us actually talk about sex, you know, in the workplace, among our friends, but we don't talk about sexuality. We don't talk about what's the new thinking about human sexuality, and that's where I want to bring you in, Nisha. Yeah. You know, as somebody who's a transgender activist, I mean, you have been at the kind of forefront for a lot of prejudiced thinking about sexuality and human sexuality. Being transgendered yourself, I mean, you're kind of on the line of people who don't accept you for who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, what's the kind of difficult question, or what are the difficult conversations that need to happen about sexuality?
I think the main thing is that, you know, even when you talk about sexuality, when it comes to transgender, it's just not about sexuality, it's about gender identity. And people don't even understand that the differences between one's gender identity and sexuality is not the same. You know, when you talk about sexuality, most of them people think it's either male or female. It's always in the binary, right? And but people forget, when you talk about gender, it's about who you are and what, how do you express yourself, who you think you are, basically, right? And all this has been basically controlled, or basically been dictated by certain people that want us to tick on the boxes and be in this kind of social construct created by them, eventually marginalize people that doesn't conform to the norms of the society.
Okay. Afifa, you know, and I know you're on Twitter, and, you know, since May 9th, with the political break that we had, there's been an extraordinary moment. In fact, very recently, I mean, just until recently, questions about the transgender community has come up over and over again. And very early on in the Pakatan Harapan administration, this came up. Were you surprised? I imagine you were far away when this happened.
Yeah.
Were you surprised by the hate or the kinds of conversations that were happening, or people allowed themselves to say in the public sphere about transgender people?
I don't think I was surprised. I think we've known for some time that conservatism is rising in Malaysia, and we've known for some time that there's there's a complete inability to look at data and say that, okay, and also human rights, like, you know, treating trans people as, you know, abominations is not going to drive down HIV infections. In fact, that's going to exacerbate them. It's going to mean that transgender people can't get normal jobs. You know, the normal job spaces are closed for them. That's not good for stability of a nation. It's not good for economics. There's no, you know, there's no interpretation of a trans person beyond the physicality, or you know, it's immediately going to, you know, people immediately think of things which are not economics related or anything
right.
else.
So,
which is,
yeah, there's a lot of self-righteousness. I mean, Martin, it does seem to me that we had a political breakthrough, but
yes.
But what we need is a social and cultural breakthrough, right? And when it comes to people's thinking about the world and each other.
Which comes from a political breakthrough. So I think we are at the first step. We've broken the mold now, which is allowing both liberal and conservatism to rise in society. But what bothers me the most when you talk about transgender rights or accessing treatment or care is that within, even amongst doctors, you have hate. Mm. Publicly saying things that are are not appropriate.
Right. There was a very famous viral Facebook posting, right? I think attacking Dr. Adiba and saying that, you know, even I as a doctor wouldn't want to treat these people, or I would treat them, but I don't want to live on the same planet as they do.
Well, I think it's the other way around. So she started, this doctor in the East Coast of Peninsula Malaysia started the conversation, and Professor Adiba corrected her, saying that, look, you know, you're a doctor. In order for you to be a doctor, you need to be ethically coherent, and so you're not allowed to marginalize people, because that doesn't allow them to come forward and tell you their problems, trust you, but that created a lot of backlash within her supporters, and that told us that even within the Ministry of Health and within medical profession itself, there is a lot of hate, there is a lot of stigma, and we need to deal with that kind of institutional stigma.
Right. Okay, we'll come back to all these questions shortly. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Anisha Ayob, Fifa Rahman and Martin Chu. We're talking about HIV/AIDS. Let's come back to yet another death. Reuters, in a piece today titled Death of Transgender Woman in Malaysia Sparks Fear of Rising Hate Crimes. Mm-hmm. This is a reference to a murder that happened last Thursday in Klang, involved a 32-year-old transgender woman and seven young men, some of them quite young, I think 16 or so.
13 and 16.
13 and 16. And they had claimed that the transgender individual had stolen a phone, but the violence then had escalated. Now, the police say it was not a hate crime. And Nisha, you were on record in this Reuters piece saying you think it's a hate crime. Can you explain why you think it was a hate crime and the police and say it isn't?
Okay, definitely. Every time when a case happened in such a way towards trans people, and whenever we say it's a hate crime, the enforcers would deny it, right? Eventually, I think people would need to understand the meaning of hate crime itself, right? For instance, this case about the trans woman being murdered in Klang, right? She was so-called accused of stealing the phone of these boys. My question is, if it wasn't a transgender woman, if it was a cisgender woman or non-transgender person, would these boys then acted in such violent way, right? And if yes, the accused was so-called to stole this phone, why didn't this boy just make a report? Right, and this happened actually based on what the police said, right, in the papers, that this happened on November, and why is it only now they attack her? It was basic plan, and because her identity was a transgender person, I totally believe it was based on hate crime.
Right. Okay. You know, Fifa, could you help me out on this? Because the question of marginality, vulnerability, or atmosphere where, you know, some politicians have ramped up their kind of hateful speech against transgender individuals, how does it relate to, say, crime? And this kind of thing. Would you be persuaded that this was a hate crime?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what we were talking about earlier in terms of an enabling environment. I think what people don't realize is that when, you know, sort of rhetoric that is grounded in hatred is publicized and you know, just blasted all over the place, people get inspired by that. And when certain people are inspired to hate on others, it's the marginalized communities who are going, okay, I'm not going to go and get a HIV test, or I'm not going to go and get a condom from the shop, or you know, I'm not going to do that because I don't want to face that hate. So you know, absolutely. And what we have on the internet, and when I put out a bunch of tweets about, you know, gay people are around us, they are our politicians, they are our newscasters, they are our doctors, you know, I said something like that, and I got a lot of hate.
And fathers and mothers, perhaps.
There are
well.
Fathers and mothers, absolutely. And you know, there are a lot of people saying, like, oh, go and die. And you're like, Okay.
Yeah, they're a simple solution to the problem. Martin, how do you see this, especially, you know, with you at KL AIDS Support Services Society? Do you see a lot of people who are marginalized? Nisha's organization, Seed Foundation, works with all marginalized communities, including the transgender community, but not only the transgender community. What does marginalization do to the story of getting access or, you know, or getting better and healthier?
So violence can happen in many ways. So what FIFA was talking about just now, one way to look at it is structural violence, right? The way society is organized creates, takes away your certain rights. And this allows you to access care, which means that instead of getting better, instead of being able to address a particular health concern, like HIV or sexually transmitted infections, you can't. And you use other means that are unorthodox in order to address these concerns, which makes it worse for you. So your health is dependent on how people decide to curtail your access. And we work a lot with people like this. So we have a project that works with men who have sex with men. And a lot of them are Malay Muslim youth, being very, very difficult for them to access care because they're very afraid. They're afraid of how the society will judge them. They're afraid of how the nurses, the doctors will look at them. And there are cases of being discriminated against. For example, I won't name the hospital. This person went with anal pain. And instead of treating the anal pain, he was referred to a hospital. They asked him to come back. So they put his appointment till the end of the day and then asked him to come back in 2 weeks. They did that twice.
And what was the reason? What could be the reason for doing so?
Well, I don't know. We should find out.
Okay. So you're in this field. I mean, Anisha, coming back to the question of transgender people, I mean, it seemed to be, especially in that incident over the removal of your portrait and Punky Tik's portrait in Penang and this exchange between you and Mujahid Yusuf Rawa, did you feel that things are changing, at least from government, at least from the top layers of the political establishment, a much more conciliatory, open, conversation could happen between you and politicians?
To be honest, I had much hope in this new Malaysia at the beginning, right? I tried engaging and I tried reaching out to all politicians, but the only one that responded to me was basically Mujahid, Dato' Mujahid, right? And it is very sad at the same time that the discussion that I had with YB Mujahid was basically overturned by media, basically trying to change the whole agenda of that discussion towards the topic of toilet. You see? So
you blame the media sometimes as well?
Sometimes I do blame the media. At the same time, I do blame politicians who tend to say something and at the same time reverse back, you see? Or maybe they're just so scared to be upfront of what they feel is right, right? Because for me, honestly, if you say that one person has a certain right, it should not be basically based on their gender, race or whatsoever. It should apply to everybody, right?
Right. And non-discrimination is an issue I think this government seems to want to take up. And we had that recent statement from the Minister of Human Resources about not discriminating at the workforce of people with HIV/AIDS. FIFA, just coming back to the question of sexuality and this government, are you hopeful that things can change? Yeah, I know politicians look at votes, right? I mean, that's the most, and they're terrified of the conservative lobby.
Yeah.
So what do we do? It's not a Malaysian story. It's not an exclusively Malaysian story.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's happening everywhere in Hungary and the United States, everywhere. It's going to be really hard. I want to be optimistic, and I want to say that we can look beyond our prejudices and look beyond whatever preconceived notions we have and look at the data, look at what's going to benefit the nation long-term, economically, security-wise, stability-wise, health-wise, HIV-wise. So, you know, treating people as equals, ensuring that they have access to healthcare has a net positive effect on the economy and stability. I just don't know if people, you know, as voters are going to be able to look past that in the near future.
Right. And Martin, what's your take? I mean, do you think we can change the terms of the conversation so that we can have a much more pragmatic approach, a pragmatic approach that brought down transmissions by, you know, intravenous drug use dramatically? Such a wonderful success story. Pragmatism that, you know, lowered mother-to-child transmission as well.
I think Malaysia in the region is a beacon. We have, when push comes to shove, we have been able to show great forbearance in making the right decision. We need to continue doing that. So I'm actually very optimistic. I know it sounds difficult sometimes to believe that, but I'm optimistic. I'm hearing these the speech by read out by the health minister from the PM. I'm hearing really positive voices, a positive approach. And I think we need to continue doing that because policy can change society. We know that. And if we have really progressive policy, it can change the society for the better.
Okay, we'll come back to and look deeper into the question of decriminalisation on a whole load of things. Now, stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. Let's come back to the question of decriminalisation. It was mentioned earlier, and the difficult conversations that need to be held. I mean, just to give government credit, right? So we had some extraordinary successes. We mentioned it, you know, intravenous drug use, transmissions have dropped, mother-child transmissions have dropped. Yeah. Part of it happens, it seems, when government outsources difficult conversations to somebody else, like the Malaysian AIDS Council or Foundation, right? FIFA, since you were at MAC, and you don't have to speak for them, but tell us about that. I mean, is that a viable strategy in a country where politicians are loath to take on the conservative lobby, but at the same time, they really do want to address the problem?
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was working there, you know, a lot of things were outsourced to the Malaysian AIDS Council. And what you don't realise is that, you know, on the global stage, when the WHO and when the UN starts awarding Malaysia with things, it's then when the government goes, oh, OK, this is great, let's get involved. So there are multiple strategies to get involved in the arena. And it's, you know, the needle and syringe discussion was very difficult in the start. And
right, this is a needle exchange program.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Absolutely. And when the Malaysian AIDS Council got involved and you know, it started rolling out and HIV infections started going down, and Malaysia was one of the top five countries in terms of HIV by intravenous drug use. And when that started going down, that's when the government was like, realizing that this was achieving a lot of positive results in the global stage. It was, you know, positioning Malaysia in the global stage in such a way that, you know, was positive, and, you know, there were advantages to this.
So the politicians were cajoled, they were excited, they were seduced by the idea of winning awards and looking good and making those speeches.
Yeah.
Nisha, do you find that you could have allies? I mean, it seems that, you know, with some of the accolades that you have, I mean, you won the International Women of Courage Award by the US government in 2016. Like I said, you have a slug named after you, you have a day in San Diego, the USA. Do you think that changes the conversation? Does it make bureaucrats, politicians more receptive to you?
To be honest, it does. It actually made people actually listen to me. And because of the first award that I get by the US state, it actually made people, and my meeting with Obama, basically, it actually made people say that, okay, we need to listen to this person that never so-called exists in Malaysia. So it does give me a kind of recognition in from a local context. At the same time, it does give me a kind of blanket of shield.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you are protected, but other transgender individuals within the community, and we have that tragic case of a transgender woman being murdered in Klang recently. Do they have enough protection?
No, sadly they don't. And this is very crucial because most trans people out there, they feel that they are not a part of the system. And the cases that you hear are only reported cases. There are a lot of unreported cases, and when trans people faces any kind of violences, they would not report it, you know, because they feel they're not protected in the system. And I'm sad to say that I work directly with the community. Like, for instance, my drop center is in Chow Khet, right? We have trans people coming up to us, being beaten up and so on. And when we ask them, have you made a report? They say, no, we better not, because the enforcers will not take any action.
OK, let's say we had a shift in policy, Martin, and, you know, we decriminalise homosexuality and we decriminalise, drug addiction and so on. Do you think it will change social attitudes? Would it prevent people from hating, for instance?
I think a lot of the conservatism is based on fear, right? You're afraid that if you were to allow... you were to recognize homosexuality or drug use, then you'll create an immoral society. Like, people will start behaving with same-sex, wanting same-sex marriage, or they'll start using a lot of drugs. But what we're seeing, and that's what FIFA is trying to say many times now, around the world, in societies where this has occurred, there has not been an increase, there has not been an influx of same-sex behaviour, there has not been an influx of drug use. So when people see that, look, oh, so the fear is irrational, the fear is not real, I'm actually afraid because I'm afraid for my family, or I want to protect my own turf. And they see that whatever you're changing in society doesn't actually erode my rights, I think people will start to relax. But unfortunately, it requires the first step is the most difficult. So having the moral courage, having the political will to make that difficult first step is...
Okay, let's look at the decriminalisation. You say evidence-based policymaking. FIFA, you've interacted with people in the ministry, the various relevant ministries. Are they open to evidence-based discussions and global conversations?
There are certain ministries that aren't. Addiction, for example, is multi-layered. It's complex. There are many reasons why people use drugs. People who use drugs or problematically use drugs. And I have to explain that because only 18% of people worldwide who use drugs are using them problematically. A lot of them are like, say, President Obama, who used drugs in college.
Who you met, by the way. Right? So I should touch you at some point, just so I could say I've touched Obama kind of vicariously. But okay.
Yeah.
So the recreational drug user.
Yeah.
Right. And then we've seen, of course, globally, the change of perceptions on cannabis. Cannabis is now a growth industry in Canada, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And useful for treatment of epilepsy in children, which is proven. It reduces epilepsy by 50% in children. So, you've got this situation. But there are some people in ministries who are very averse to the data, who are relying on, these parents called me and say we want this in policy, so we are going to do that. And you're like, that's not data.
So
that's
anecdotal kind of evidence.
Yeah. What we need is a reliance on the science and a reliance on the data and a reliance on so many case studies. Like in Portugal, so many positive results have come out of Portugal, including reducing unemployment and reducing overdose deaths. So,
hearing from you, Martin, and help me out this. You know, you worked again. Your research was on, say, with the fishing community, intravenous drug use. When you present this to bureaucrats, what do you hope will happen, and what happens often?
Interestingly, so we presented our findings to the Lembaga Kemajuan Malaysia, interestingly, they were not surprised, right? Nobody was surprised with our findings, but they knew
intuitively, or they're just from experience.
I think the whole industry knows that if you work in deep sea fishing, because you're gone for sometimes months at a time, you will need to take certain substances in order to remain productive right? Because of the change of activity, the change of sleep patterns, and so on. But how do we deal with the harms that come with it? In order for us to deal with the harms, we need to be able to address drug use or substance use in a way that is demoralized. So take away the moral aspect of it, take away what is right and what is wrong, and look at the utility of it, the functionality of it, which is what my research was based on.
Okay, we're going to come back to maybe some of the best practices that we could learn from, or at least interesting conversations, and plug ourselves into that in the next segment. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with Meesha Radhakutan. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk with Meesha Radhakutan. I have Nisha Ayub, Pipa Rahman, and Martin Chu. All of them helping me understand what the kind of conversations we need to kind of grapple with if we're going to truly move the country forward in terms of dealing with HIV/AIDS as an epidemic, but also just becoming a much more inclusive and a nicer society. We don't have to be so nasty as some people are. Okay. Very quickly, before we forget, Nisha, your organization, Seed Foundation, is having a fundraiser, and that's Jazz It Up for Charity on February 16th, 2019, right?
That's right.
Okay. What's the website for Seed Foundation? How's it?
Just Google Seed Malaysia or Seed Foundation, and you can have our website.
Okay. Yeah. So let's, look, if you were sitting with the minister or ministers involved and politicians, what would you be saying to them in terms of policy? What is it that you would say, first steps, let's do this. Low-hanging fruit, what can we achieve in the near term?
Okay, first step is listen to the community first. I've seen people speaking on behalf of the community. That's one part of it.
And that's a problem?
That is the main problem.
Okay.
Because people tend to speak on behalf. You know, we have all these preachers going out there saying LGBT is the cause of all the floods in the world, you see? So listen to
us. You are like
us.
Rainmakers. You're like modern rainmakers and tsunami creators, apparently.
There you go.
Okay.
There right? So first of all, listen to the community themselves first, right? Second of all, They need to look our view from our own community themselves, from our own culture. Because the problem is now that people tend to talk, when they talk about LGBT, they always apply, that's a Western culture. Mm. But they forget that LGBT people, including transgender people, we are born in Malaysia, for God's sake, right? And our issues is totally different from Western or whichever states, right? And then create policy that protects people. As you mentioned the word, I like the word inclusive, because people often use the word, let's be diverse, but how inclusive are you enough to be diverse, right? Which is very good. And so when you talk about policy, when it comes to trans people, right, I would really, really hope they would start to recognize that trans people exist.
Okay, so your existence and your full humanity, I think, definitely a kind of conversation that needs to be held. Martin, talk to me about what kind of positive stories are there in this conversation around policy, around HIV/AIDS, around in the inclusion of marginalized communities. What are they? Are there interesting conversations out there that we should be plugging ourselves into?
I'm not quite sure about interesting conversations, but I think credit needs to be, credit where it's due. The Malaysian Ministry of Health is now providing free testing, HIV testing and treatment to all Malaysians, which is really quite amazing in the world of HIV, right? But even then, despite this free testing and treatment, people are not coming forward to test and treat. Mm. So
yeah, and I want to add to that. You were reported as saying that young people are not doing it, and partly because they have to have their parents' consent. And you want that decoupled. You want young people to be able to avail themselves of these things without parental consent.
Well, the reason parental consent is important is because you're looking after the welfare of the child, and you don't want a child to be exploited. But when it comes to sexuality or sex, we know that children are having sex very early in life, and their parents may not know. their parents may not approve. And if the parents know, then it may be worse off for them.
So they might go hide and still do it, but...
They're going to do whatever they're going to do.
Right.
I think we cannot control what the youth of today will or will not do. I think as adults, we try to, right? the nanny state, you try to subvert... The youth will try to subvert the youth will try to find a way to express themselves and be contrary to society. I think society needs to embrace that creativity in the youth.
Well, okay, so this comes back to the kind of conservative pushback. So, yes, we can effectively control our children. We'll keep the girl child at home until whenever she gets married or whatever, or we'll keep boys on a very tight leash. I mean, they do believe they have mechanisms for controlling individuals, including young people. So, I mean, is there a way we can find a bridge between that conversation that believes they can control and us who believes that maybe it's something to celebrate in young people and we just give them the tools to protect themselves?
Yeah, I think it really comes back to reliance on data and science because, there's this whole idea that religion can protect children from having sex. And we looked at rape statistics highest in Kelantan. HIV is quite high in Kelantan, you know, and we've got Sharia police assaulting trans people. You know, it's a situation where we've got to look at what works best for children. And parental consent is something that, at the WHO and UN level, which is more where I work at the minute, you know, parental consent is absolutely something that needs to be removed because that will make sure that people get tested. And right now we have only 45% of people eligible to receive treatment, receiving treatment. So only 45%. And, you know, we're supposed to be ending AIDS by 2030. If we don't remove these barriers to access services, we are not going to reach elimination.
Aoife, is it actually possible to eliminate AIDS from, is it possible?
Yes. It is, I would say, absolutely. But we need to ensure that the policy matches. We need to embrace the new technologies that are coming up. So in my work at UNITAID has just approved a new area for intervention on injectable PrEP. So PrEP is giving HIV-negative people access to HIV drugs to prevent them from getting HIV.
So it's like a prophylaxis, it's like a medical condom, basically.
Absolutely.
A chemical condom.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's right. Good way.
And UNITAID funds HIV self-testing all over Africa, for example. We need to ensure that HIV self-testing is available to people. And also we've got to think about co-infections because TB is the largest killer of people living with HIV worldwide. And we've got a drug, bedaquiline, which is actually very good, less side effects than the current one, which can cause deafness. But the problem is it's too expensive. So there are all these other things that need to happen to eliminate HIV and eliminate deaths among people living with HIV.
Okay, in the remaining minutes that we have, a very quick round for all of you. Nisha, if you could meet somebody in government today to talk about your concerns, who would you be talking to?
I would love to meet with our Prime Minister, Tun Dr. Mahathir.
Okay, so Tun Dr. Mahathir is the Prime Minister. He's setting the tone for his cabinet. Martin, who would you like to talk to?
Also Tun Dr. Mahathir, but also, the Health Minister. I think the Ministry of Health has done a lot for pushing the boundaries for HIV support services. But right now, there are gaps, and the gaps need to be filled if we're going to really make a success of it. We have all the tools available.
Remember. Okay, so both of you, kind of like on from the top, start from the top of the pyramid and move down. Aoife, who would you like to talk to?
I'll start from the top too, but I'll go trade, because I'm privy to all this intimidation that United States is doing against international health agencies who want to reduce prices of medicines and who want to sort of challenge patents that are unmerited and bring these prices down. So there's a lot of threats happening against the WHO. There are threats happening against the Malaysian government. So on the compulsory license Malaysia did on hepatitis, which is a HIV co-infection, the Malaysian ambassador in DC was called to the Capitol, intimidated, you know, all that kind of stuff. The trade ministry is the main target for that kind of intimidation. And, you know, I would just like to give them data that shows that there's no reason to be intimidated.
Okay, that's wonderful. I mean, this conversation could carry on. Clearly, we're going to have to bring all of you back. I do think we need to talk to our enforcement officers. We're going to have to talk to our police officers. We're going to have to talk to DBKL doctors. We're going to have to give doctors a bit of a talking to as well, it seems. Yeah. Okay, I've been speaking to Nisha Ayub, Afifa Rahman, and also Martin Chu, all of them helping me understand what's going on. This has been Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan, only on Astro Awani.